We're checking in on nonprofits in these challenging times. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. They work on food and housing security. They work on social justice, education, healthcare access, climate change, animal rights, the arts. And that's just tip of the iceberg. A report by Deloitte's Monitor Institute in July, it stated that upwards of 2 in 5 nonprofits could consolidate or close during the next 12 to 18 months. And it said organizations in the arts, education, and other spaces that don't lend themselves to remote service delivery may be particularly vulnerable. Do you support a charitable group and worry about its viability? Do you work or volunteer for a nonprofit? How is it going? We're at 800-642-1234. Mary Beth Collins is Executive Director of the UW-Madison Center for Community and Nonprofit Studies. Mary Beth, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So 7 months into this, you know, broad strokes here, if you will, how are charitable organizations doing?
Right. Well, I think the first thing that's really important to point out in answer to that question is to really underscore the way that nonprofit community and civil society organizations really rose to meet the moment of COVID-19 and the other pandemics that we're living in as a society, notwithstanding the challenges that you refer to in your intro. So I hope we get to explore that a little bit as well, because I think often this sector and the way that it innovates and is nimble and meets the moment, often with limited resources, is something that as a community, as a society, we need to explore more. But as of right now, in terms of some of the challenges that you referred to, I think it's fair to say that we're in a moment 7 months in where it's not fully clear exactly how the sector will be impacted for the long term. We know from research that we did in Wisconsin that initially upon the executive orders and initial responses to COVID-19, that many organizations were facing pretty dire concerns about their fundraising and their ability to deliver programming because so many modalities had to change and big group gatherings were not possible. And meanwhile, they were also extending themselves to meet needs that had arisen in their stakeholder groups that had not been there before. I mean, suddenly, if you're serving the elderly, you have to find entirely new modalities to make sure that they have their basic needs met. Food pantries had to completely revise their programming. And so in those early reports that we got from nonprofits, you know, there was a lot of concern and uncertainty about how they were going to continue programming under the circumstances, especially with funding being very up in the air because of program revenues and fundraising events in particular being halted in many cases. In that same wave, however, we knew that many of those organizations were actively applying for at that time, some of the federal relief funding that mm-hmm. came through. And that actually did have, I think, a stabilizing impact in many cases. And then since that time also, I think many nonprofits, to my earlier point, have been able to find very creative pivots. And depending on their funding relationships and their communities, there have been localized opportunities to still get support from funders and from emergency relief funds that were made available in certain communities. Although I don't want to overemphasize that to take away from there's still a long road ahead and we still are not sure exactly how long this situation is going to last
yeah.
or how long the effects of the same dynamics that were there in the spring could continue well beyond October 2020.
Well, you mentioned the federal help, the Paycheck Protection Program loans were out there, you know, and there was some friction over that because when you look in the arts sector, a handful of the country's largest museums were given $5, $10 million through the PPP loans. And there was the rub that, you know, these are organizations with very big endowments, and we were leaving the smaller organizations that really needed the help behind. How did you feel about how this friction evolved?
Right. Well, I mean, I will admit that I was not necessarily, a student of every twist and turn of how the legislation was passed. But as a general, up-to-date citizen, I think what we saw was there was a need for relatively rapid legislation. And to be sure, the amount of stakeholder input that we would like for that kind of a process probably didn't or couldn't happen. There could have perhaps been better efforts to engage small nonprofit organizations, the service industry, organizations led by people of color in communities that don't have great financial institution relationships. I mean, in an ideal world, that kind of input would have played into the way the legislation was drafted initially, but I don't think that happened. And so what I think we got was a first wave of lending that intended to really not have any eligibility factors that would say, even if you have an endowment or even if you're a huge national corporation, you somehow have a different eligibility factor than smaller organizations that are probably more up against the wall. In other words, if you could just prove that your, you know, operations were disrupted, you could get this lending.
You were cleared.
Yeah. And on top of that, because the original source of funding was routed through traditional financial institutions, what we were hearing was that, bankers were basically just bombarded with calls from organizations that hoped that they were eligible and knew that they needed to have a financial institution partner to access the loans. Well, naturally, what ends up happening is those people that have their banker on speed dial or have a very big portfolio with the bank were sort of first in line to get the first tranche of funding. So that was super frustrating for both small businesses and nonprofit organizations because they felt like they were probably the most in need. And for the same inequities that tend to exist across large to small organizations, they were being once again put at the back of the line. But I will say that the second or the later tranches of such funding did come through more easily for those organizations. And frankly, because to the credit of the legislature, the feedback and outcry that was coming from those smaller orgs, I think hit the legislative context, and they started to incorporate some pivots into the way that the program was administered.
We're talking with Mary Beth Collins, Executive Director of the UW-Madison Center for Community and Nonprofit Studies. We're discussing the state of philanthropic organizations amid the pandemic. Do you work for a nonprofit? What challenges is your organization facing? How have you had to adapt your programs to continue to serve your clients? Join in at 800-642-1234. Mary Beth, I'm sure you have your ear to the ground and you really know quite a few different examples of how nonprofits have been able to pivot in these times or make some creative solutions to be able to continue their programming. What are some examples of this?
Yes. Well, thank you for asking that question. I think highlighting these stories is really important at this time. I mean, initially, I will just say, so I think it's important to kind of frame this as a little bit of a chronological journey, because none of us have ever seen this situation before. And that was certainly true in the nonprofit sector. So I'm going to try to represent examples that arose at different points in this journey. So in the very beginning, what we saw that was so incredible was a lot of mutual aid networks kind of kicking into gear. So some informal groups that were actually kind of maybe not your typical nonprofit organization that you think of when you think of, you know, who you donate to every year or who has a big gala that you go to, but rather some more grassroots type coalitions that started to activate almost immediately when they realized that some community members' basic needs were going to be really in jeopardy with the need to stay home and not be able to access resources in traditional environments when COVID restrictions really set in. Not to mention the health concerns that also created vulnerabilities for folks. So in Wisconsin, we saw this come up with a lot of grassroots volunteers and quick solutions being arrived at. And then over time, we saw also different innovations that I'm hoping we can explore a little bit further.
Let's pause right there with Mary Beth Collins, Executive Director of the UW-Madison Center for Community and Nonprofit Studies. We're asking her about how the nonprofit sector is holding up. 800-642-1234 to join in. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're checking in on how nonprofits are doing. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Donors may have lost their work or may fear losing their job, be less likely to make good on their normal donations. Corporate donors, it may be hard to keep up charitable contributions if they struggle with cash flow and making payroll. And of course, those big fundraiser galas not happening. How is your nonprofit surviving? Have you had to do layoffs or furloughs? How long will you be able to operate in these conditions? Be part of this, 800-642-1234. We have Mary Beth Collins, who heads up the UW-Madison Center for Community and Nonprofit Studies, and she stays with us for 10 more minutes. Mary Beth, you were talking there about these grassroots coalitions that emerged early on in the pandemic, these mutual aid networks. What does that mean?
Yeah, so a lot of times they would be formed out of groups that kind of already had a mission, but that came together to make sure that their community was basically getting through and their basic needs were met. And so you saw folks, you know, creating hotlines and checking in on people that were isolated at home, doing food deliveries, making sure people had their medicines, and all of those things that in that very initial wave were extremely tenuous and had a lot of risk involved. But then to kind of get back to what other innovations and pivots we saw in the sector, then you really saw the traditional nonprofit organizations kicking in their plans as well. So organizations that had big fundraisers planned, you know, would be adjusting their plans for that, maybe to do something virtual or to postpone or both. You saw organizations that served youth and families, you know, pivoting their programming from after school programming or camps to supporting families at home with their virtual learning. You saw organizations that provided basic needs like food pantries and health services and childcare, figuring out, like many other organizations and businesses, how to deliver those services safely with huge modifications to the on-site situations. And then you saw organizations addressing new needs. So one thing we saw was, you know, people that were receiving other services were now reporting, for example, increased needs for mental health supports because they were suddenly isolated at home. So you saw organizations starting to explore that. And over those months that have intervened since April, I think it's almost impossible to represent the full range of pivots and innovations and technological changes that organizations have used to basically still meet their mission these circumstances. And be in conversation ideally with funders and tell their story differently so that they can keep that flow of connection and support going with those that help them keep going. But that's been a big challenge as well, as I think we can all imagine.
Wondering how the employees are holding up because, you know, here in our state, 1 in 12 employees works at a nonprofit. It's a, you know, a big chunk of the economy and annual wages. What are you seeing there? And are they able to keep their payroll?
Right. So I think, you know, the infusion of the aid that I referred to, and then some of the local emergency funds and opportunities that have been put together by funders have helped many Wisconsin nonprofit organizations keep some stability to their payroll. We know that volunteer opportunities have gone down a ton for obvious reasons. I mean, it's hard to, a lot of volunteer roles are in-person roles, and a lot of volunteers are more vulnerable with the health concerns of today. Regarding the way that employees are doing, I mean, I think that it's a challenge on a lot of levels. I mean, for one thing, nonprofit employees, I don't want to overly generalize, but these are people who are very invested in their communities and the well-being of their communities. And the fact of the matter is they are seeing on a daily basis the struggles of not only COVID-19, but other ills of our society, including systemic racism. And so that work of being in a nonprofit that is always a challenge where you're engaged with really tough issues is going to continue to be a challenge and is probably exacerbated at this time, just in the job that people are doing. But on top of that, a lot of those folks have had to pivot to doing things via Zoom and doing things virtually and finding new modalities and learning new skills and perhaps even changing programming or doing more grant applications for emergency funds. So they're also kind of being piled on with additional roles that are probably different than before. And then I think that the relative kind of lingering and, you know, uncertainty in the atmosphere of like, maybe we have our 6-month plan and our budget in place for now, but like there's still a question of how this is going to affect us in the long term probably adds a lot of stress. And then it is notable that all of these people, just like school teachers and others, are often doing this work more and more from home, perhaps with their own families and, you know, Zoom life and work from home life going going on, or they're on the front lines of food pantries and childcare centers and human services organizations and clinics where they're front lines workers and they're exposing themselves to risk. So those are some overall reflections. I think it's a stressful time.
Mary Beth Collins is executive director of the UW-Madison Center for Community and Nonprofit Studies. We're checking in on the health of nonprofits amid the pandemic, taking your questions and the circumstances you're facing with the nonprofit you're a part of. 800-642-1234. Mary Beth, I would imagine it's particularly difficult for organizations that really rely heavily on their budget for, you know, pay for services. I'm thinking like field trips to museums that are now just not existence, or camps, summer camps and things like that. Or, you know, even the Nutcracker that you put on, that is your biggest revenue moneymaker in your budget. How do you negotiate those types of drops in funding?
Yes, absolutely. And I would say that those are the organizations that I think probably have the most acute concerns right now about their continuation. I mean, arts organizations that rely on tickets and sponsorships, where the live production really matters. I mean, there have been incredible innovations with those types of organizations and organizations, as I mentioned, that provide youth programming and such. But the notion that you can still collect the same amount for something virtual is just, it's not going to hold up. And I think, you know, I don't think anybody has great answers, but I think that, you know, questions have arisen that are very important. Like, should some of these activities in our society and our communities be better supported so that it's not hand to mouth every month or every year? And that if you have an unexpected twist like this, that of course is historic, but still that it shouldn't necessarily be existential that our theaters or our enrichment activities, you know, be able to continue when there is a situation like this. So I think, you know, there's probably a lot going on right now behind the scenes with stalwart donors and believers in this type of work. And we hope that they're able to come through. But as you mentioned, donors themselves are facing economic ambiguity right now with everything that's going on. I think communities and public sectors and community foundations and United Ways and those coalescing entities that help look at the sector really should be looking at how do we keep the fabric of our communities going so that these organizations are not constantly struggling to meet their operational needs.
And these are going to be some hard decisions, hard choices to make.
Yeah, that's right. And I think I don't have the answer of how those organizations that are very fee for service based are going to make it. But I think, again, in some ways, we're still in a relatively early stage of this. And it'll be very interesting to see how the full annual budget cycle plays out over the course of COVID.
We touched on this so very briefly, and I want to make sure that we look at it closely. Racial disparities and racism have affected philanthropic organizations, this sector, and highlighted the racial disparities. What are some of the ways you see this coming out in nonprofits?
Right. Well, there's very concerning data that came out from the Chronicle of Philanthropy that organizations led by Black leaders and leaders of color have had a harder time accessing certain philanthropic funds. And there's even evidence in Wisconsin based on some kind of new research about just the totally different experience of leaders of color in nonprofit organizations. And that's something that the sector needs to reckon with. You know, people tend to think of the nonprofit sector as altruistic and an engine for social change. And all of that is true, but the sector itself certainly has a history of you know, being exclusive, having white privilege all over it. And so the sector itself needs to do some work with that. I think there is some hope right now that the summer of 2020 has created some new energy around, you know, really committing to equity in our communities. And I think funders and others with influence are taking steps to make funding opportunities available and supportive opportunities available so that those closest to the problems of our historic legacy with racism can be in the lead on nonprofit and civil society efforts. There's still a long road ahead with that too. But organizations that are, you know, one, I think thing we should also emphasize is those organizations that are working in communities of color have seen the most devastating impacts of COVID. They were already facing many basic needs, vulnerabilities, because of systemic racism. And now they're often the organizations that are also advocating for census results, get out the vote, and helping people through this moment of acute, you know, reminders of the racism in our society and fighting for social change. And so those organizations are bearing so much. And so to the extent we can support them and coalition build to position them as well as possible, that's something that I think we all need to be thinking about too.
Mary Beth, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Mary Beth Collins heads up the UW-Madison Center for Community and Nonprofit Studies. Coming up, we talk with a member of a state task force focusing on missing and murdered Indigenous women. That's after this news update here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we talk about the work of Wisconsin's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Dozens of people were named to the task force this month by Attorney General Josh Call in partnership with our state's tribal nations. Call told WBAY-TV that data reporting is lacking.
There isn't great data collection on this issue, and that's because it hasn't been examined through the lens specifically of missing and murdered women in Indigenous communities.
What do you want to tell this task force? How should it approach the work? We're at 800-642-1234. Task force member Kristen Welsh is from the Menominee Nation, lead organizer for Manikonikim Menominee Women's Leadership Cohort for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. Kristen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us about the scope of this problem? How many missing or murdered Indigenous women are there in Wisconsin?
That's part of the issue that the task force is going to have to address. We're not really sure how big the scope is here in Wisconsin. There's never really been done formal studies on it. Well, we do have a few grassroots numbers, and we estimate that about 25, but we know it's much higher than that.
Right, because, I mean, we've seen some federal data showing somewhat modest, if you will, numbers, but then other data showing thousands of women. Why the disparity?
Well, I think there's not a formal system that allows people to enter into one system. So there's a lot of confusion as to what entered into it, how do we enter into it, and not every county and police department is entering in the same information. And on top of that, a lot of times we're misclassified. Indigenous women aren't always classified as an Indigenous woman in the system that has gone missing or murdered. So that also attributes to the low numbers.
What do you think is the most urgent need that this task force should be addressing as it starts to meet, as it starts to form? I mean, there are dozens of people, all with different perspectives. What do you hope to focus on?
I think if we can start to look at the root causes, we really want to use the strategic plan that was put in place by the Women's Leadership Cohort. And that's going to be able to kind of break the larger problem down, because there's thousands of issues that lead up to MMIW. But we know that data collection is one of them. And if we can start with the data, that usually pushes the resources. So we definitely want to tackle that piece, but we need to look at the responsive and preventative services and how they're interacting with law enforcement, with the families, what are the relationships between state and federal preventative services. But we also need to respect the tribal rights to self-determine and what, as tribal nations, that they can do also.
Yeah, and you're part of the Menominee Nation. How is this issue discussed in your community?
Well, I think right now we're trying to tackle it from quite a few different perspectives. We have a lot of grassroots work happening within the community. Manikonikim and the Women's Leadership Cohort is part of that, and I think we're probably leading that conversation. But I know that our police department and our agents are also trying to address it as well. So what we're trying to do within the cohort is to create better relationships between the grassroots and the work that the PD and our agents are doing so that we can better serve our families.
Where do you see communication as broken down between police departments and tribal nations and the autonomy there?
There's not always the greatest relationships between the tribal nations and their partnering counties. And then you have jurisdictional issues. So who has jurisdiction? That can get a little bit confusing. And that's one of the issues that really needs to be addressed by the task force, too, is streamlining the jurisdiction process and understanding who has jurisdiction in certain issues, creating better forms of communication and process and procedure for MMIW.
And it also sounds like, you know, who's going to take leadership on this case? Who's going to see it through? Who's going to make sure it doesn't fall through the cracks?
Exactly. There has to be accountability in there. And making sure that the families are taken care of in the process. I think that's one of the bigger issues that we see is that a lot of times there's not clear communication to the families what's going on. And they're kind of just left in the dark. And you can imagine how painful that is already to have a loved one be missing or murdered, but then to really not have communication. And I think that happens a lot with like our border counties to reservations, that those counties may not have the greatest relationships with their families either.
Do you find that families take up the search themselves?
Absolutely. I think of all of the families that we've helped and had worked with, they're doing a lot of the work. I've seen families do physical searches, have to go out and search for their family. But it's a lot of the awareness piece. And awareness around creating justice for the family. So, like in the case of Cozy, originally the charges did not fit the crime, and the family really had to powerfully advocate and create, you know, social media campaigns and get out and act as a lawyer, act as an activist to push for higher charges that normally would have just been charged in the first place. But I do see that they finally match the charges to her case. So there is some justice there. But I attribute to that to the work of the family.
Explain her case a little bit and what it triggered.
So when we originally were asked to help out with Cozy, they do have a really powerful advocate within their family system, Stacy. And she just really asked us to help get some awareness out about the case first. So that's what we were able to help them do. But Cozy's case is actually in another state. So the family's here in Wisconsin. Her body was found in another state. So there's some issues there as well, but it was a federal case. Originally, the suspect was just charged with manslaughter. And that certainly did not fit the crime. They found her remains, or what was left, in an outhouse. Mm. And there was not enough evidence to prove at that time, this is what we were being told, that there was anything higher than manslaughter that they could charge with. Even though he had disposed of her body, he had burned her body, he had hidden evidence. And when they came upon him, you know, he was just with their infant in this cabin. So it didn't make sense to us why he was only being charged with manslaughter, and of course to the family as well. So they went down there and they rallied in front of the federal courthouse, held several protests. We put social media out there. We put pressure on everybody involved in the case. And even though it was a federal case, we wanted to put pressure on the state and the AG as well, because they have an obligation to use their power to help these families. And through their rallying, I believe that's why those charges have been now bumped up to murder.
We have Kristen Welch with us from the Menominee Nation. She's part of Wisconsin's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force that has formed. You can join in. Do you know someone who is missing or perhaps murdered. What is that like for you to live with that? Are you a member of law enforcement? Have you been called to a reservation? What is communications like, and what about jurisdiction there? Join in with your perspective, 800-642-1234. Kristen, you know, this issue knows no boundaries, right? It doesn't respect state boundaries. Minnesota has a parallel task force that is underway. Will you work or talk with Minnesota's task force?
Oh, absolutely. We have been. I think that was part of our strategy. We've been working on the formation of it for probably since right after the hearing. Mm-hmm. There was a hearing that was held after session, and we've been working with DOJ every week since then. And we did reach out to Minnesota. We knew that they were a little bit further along in the process than us, and we wanted to see what can we learn from them, what worked, what didn't work. So they've been a great help in helping us be prepared for this first meeting and sort of what to expect and road bumps along the way.
What have they shared with you about this work?
That 1 year, year and a half is definitely not enough time to address the issue and to really be prepared that you need to have those relationships in place with the key people, you know, like law enforcement, like the advocates and the families. And I think that was one of the bigger lessons, was just being prepared for the amount of work that it's going to be. That the more digging you do, the more issues you're going to find.
Why are Native women being targeted?
I think that's probably an issue that's about 500 years old and goes back to first contact, when tribal sovereignty was really put under attack. And that's what it really comes down to, for me, in my personal opinion, is that these attacks on tribal sovereignty through policy, like the ability to, or lack of the ability to prosecute non-natives on tribal land, makes us really easy targets. So it's like the termination era, boarding school era, these were government policies to really remove identity and the strength and the governance of the tribe. Of the tribal nation. And that makes us a little bit more vulnerable than the rest of the population.
We're talking with Kristen Welch from the Menominee Nation, lead organizer for Menikanakim Menominee Women's Leadership Cohort for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. Are you part of a tribal nation? How has your life been affected by violence toward Indigenous women? Are you searching for a loved one? Do you have hope of finding her? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with Kristen Welch here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Kristen Welch. She's from the Menominee Nation, part of Wisconsin's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force. And the task force was formed in July, and dozens of people were named to it this month by the State Justice Department in concert with all of Wisconsin's tribal nations. Let's bring in Mary Ann now, who's joining us from Madison. Hi, Mary Ann. Hi, Marianne. What would you like to share? Oh, we're having difficulty hearing Marianne, but I think that she really wants to share that she's a former detective who would really like to help in some way in this work. And what would you suggest, Kristen?
Well, I know that the task force is taking advisory groups that are interested in the work. But on top of that, what you can do is really become an ally to the movement. So you can look at what the Women's Leadership Cohort is doing. You can reach out to families. And when you see those action alerts, you can really help to move them in the media.
Earlier this month, President Trump signed the Savannahs Act to, putting that into law. What does this legislation require on a federal level?
It requires some of those things that we talked about, especially around data, so that we have to look at those data systems and look at unifying one system that we're able to input the data in, and also create a pathway so it's a little bit easier access for our tribal nations to access that data and input the data as well. So when they have somebody missing, they can enter into the same system as everybody else and have access to it.
How important is having clear data collection to tackling this problem?
Well, I think if you work in policy or anything around budgeting, you understand that data moves the resources. So that if we can validate what we already know as Indigenous people, that this is an issue at the policy level, that will help move resources where it really needs to be. To preventative measures, to responsive measures, so that we don't have the violence happening in the first place.
If a girl or a woman is missing and someone wants to file a missing persons report on the reservation, what is the process to do this? What is the process like?
Well, it's similar to being off the reservation. You're immediately going to want to contact your local law enforcement and make that report. Mm-hmm. The sooner that you make that report, it initiates law enforcement into action. So that's really critical. And we have worked with a few families who have had young people go missing, and we really strongly encourage them immediately make that phone call, because the sooner they can get to work and looking for them, the sooner they can bring them home. Those first 24 hours are so critical.
We're talking with Kristen Welch from the Menominee Nation, lead organizer for Minneconica Menominee Women's Leadership Cohort for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. She's on the state task force addressing this problem, and the task force is underway. You can join in with your perspective. Are you a victim of domestic violence? Did you report it? What was done after the report? We're at 800-642-1234. Kristen, I want to talk about 22-year-old Caitlin Kelly from the Menominee Nation and the process of what happened when she went missing. Can you say anything about her situation?
Well, I know it's still an active investigation, but I do believe that our law enforcement here on the reservation acted quickly and put the resources where it needed to be. And we are really fortunate here on Menominee Reservation where they do have a good relationship with their agent, which is critical. I think that's one of the biggest pieces. What we would like to see more of is those supports for the family while the process is happening. And I think that that space of the unknown, not knowing where your family member is or your community relative is, we have to do a better job in responding to the community and the family emotionally and mentally and spiritually. So that was some of the work that the cohort was able to do, was to provide that emotional support. But I think our law enforcement did a great job responding.
Yeah. What specific supports do you see lacking or need to be provided to these families?
Well, and if it's a federal case, they do get a victim specialist. Mm-hmm. But we have had, accounts where they've actually created more trauma for the family, that they weren't as empathetic as they needed to be. There might be some cultural misunderstandings there. So they really just need to be more empathetic. They need to be culturally relevant and centered in the way that they work with our families and have clear and transparent communication. And I think that's something that they need to really look to the Indigenous grassroots that are doing that work and modeling that work already and what that looks like. How do you support a family through this? And really just making sure that they have everything they need, whether it's financially or emotionally or spiritually, so they don't have to worry about anything else.
Let's talk about Minneconica and this organization that is working on behalf of Indigenous women. What do you see there in the efforts of this nonprofit?
Well, with Minneconnachem, I mean, we really got started to protect life. It originally started with the Novak 40 mine and protecting our sacred place of creation at the mouth of the Menominee River. And the work expanded from there into these different initiatives like the Women's Leadership Cohort, food sovereignty, energy work, and understanding that those are all really the same movement. Resource extraction is directly connected to MMIW. So the work of Minneconnachem is really restoring Indigenous identity to create wellness in our community. And that's the purpose of the Women's Leadership Cohort, is to uplift Indigenous women's leadership through connecting to our original identity.
Let's bring in Bill now, joining us from Spooner this morning. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for the topic. In Wisconsin, municipalities are required to provide or provide access to emergency services like police, fire, ambulance, and that varies from the response varies from a police force that's hired and owned by the city to ambulance services that they contract for and rural fire departments that might cover multiple townships. My question is there a similar requirement for municipalities to provide the domestic abuse shelters and that sort of service?
So in terms of domestic abuse and those situations, how does that work, Kristen?
I don't know that municipalities are required to form any sort of DV shelters. If that were the case, I think we'd see a lot more. But domestic violence is definitely one of those gateways into MMIW. So we do need more responsive services like shelters and supports, but we need more preventative measures in place also.
So prevention is certainly the key there. Where do you find hope on this work?
I think we find hope in the strength of the families, and the hope is for the future for our young people, so that we're trying to create something better for that seventh generation in the future and looking forward. And I think that's where the hope is, that in the work, we're going to create something better for them.
Do you feel like you're laying the groundwork and a younger generation is working on this problem, maybe seeing it differently?
Yeah. I mean, our youth are pretty amazing. Just within our community, I think of Ayana Okamash. She's a 12-year-old girl. She's a national boxer, but she's using her platform to create awareness for MMIW. And she's just as tenacious, you know, out of the ring advocating for MMIW as she is in the ring. Mm. So, I mean, that's where, you know, part of the hope and the inspiration comes from, is those young warriors and leaders that are already doing the work at a very young age.
Kristen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Kristen Welch is from the Menominee Nation, lead organizer for Minneconnachem Menominee Women's Leadership Cohort for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. And we will be back here on the Ideas Network.